Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And what you're hearing under me right now, that's Over the Hills and Far Away by Led Zeppelin. On this day in 1972, Led Zeppelin was forced to cancel a gig in Singapore when local officials refused to let them off the plane because of their long hair. Today we celebrate and honor the life of Lucille Clifton. She was an internationally renowned poet laureate of Maryland who passed away on this day in 2010. To honor her, I brought together a panel who knew and loved her. So it gives me great pleasure and joy to bring this amazing archived edition of the Mark Steiner Show to you today. Lucille Clifton was my neighbor for many years and a dear friend. Two of her books of poetry were nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. She was a recipient of the National Book Award and was Maryland's Poet Laureate from 1974 to 1985. She wrote to us in her very original style about life, about being a black woman in America, about what it meant to be black in this world, about the earth and its non-human beings in her deeply spiritual way. She told stories of slaves and her heroes like Fannie Lou Hamer and Du Bois, and she taught us about life. So today we honor Lucille Clifton on the anniversary of her passing with an archived edition from 2010. Please enjoy the conversation.
I would like to read two poems. One is for a person, a friend, one of my dearest friends who served in the Vietnam War. And this is called What Haunts Him, for Wayne. That moment after the bartender refused to serve the dark marine and the three white-skinned others just sat there. That moment before they rose and followed their nappy brother out into the USA, they were willing to die to defend. Then. Thank you. This is called Sorrows. Who would believe them winged? Who would believe they could be beautiful? Who would believe they could fall so in love with mortals that they would attach themselves as scars attach and ride the skin? Sometimes we hear them in our dreams, rattling their skulls, clicking their bony fingers. They have heard me beseeching as I whispered into my own cupped hands, enough, not me again. But who can distinguish one human voice amid such choruses of desire?
Wayne Carlin is a writer who's written and edited many books and is known as the Dean of Writers from the Vietnam War, where he served as a Marine. He's professor in the Language and Literature Department at the College of Southern Maryland.
I knew Lucille for over 25 years. She was a dear friend, and her loss is a great hole in my life, my heart. We would go at least once a week when she was down at St. Mary's before her retirement last year. We'd go to a local cafe with the poet Michael Glazer also, and the three of us would have breakfast and talk about everything. Talk about our writing and poetry, but also the world and grandchildren and her many, many health problems. I miss her very much. I think many people miss her, and many people who never met her miss her because of what her writing meant in their lives. And, her life threw so much at her that I think would have broken and destroyed a lesser spirit. This was both, growing up, growing up poor, being poor with many children, being evicted from her house, being abused as a child. All of that wounded her deeply, and then her one medical condition after another. It just amazed me that she was still alive as long as she lived. She had to have a kidney replaced. Her daughter donated one of her kidneys. She had breast cancer. She had heart conditions. She had gout, diabetes. Every life just threw so much at her. I think she knew if she could find the words to express her personal wounds, that private pain, the words would not only sustain her, but would express the wounds and pains of many people. People who couldn't find the words because they'd been stolen from their mouths, stolen or burned in front of their eyes, the way her mother's poems once were burned in front of her eyes. She wrote about that in the poem called Fury.
What do you mean her poems were burned before her mother's eyes?
That's... if you want, I can read this poem.
Sure.
Called Fury, and it explains what happened. And it's for Mama, she says. Remember this. She is standing by the furnace. The coals glisten like rubies. Her hand is crying. Her hand is clutching a sheaf of papers, poems. She gives them up. They burn, jewels into jewels. Her eyes are animals. Each hank of her hair is a serpent's obedient wife. She will never recover. Remember, there's nothing you will not bear for this woman's sake. There's a true story of how her mother would write poetry. You know, her mother hadn't gone, you know, had dropped out before high school and had a very rough life, many kids. And she'd write poems, write poetry for herself. And one day her husband found it and did that. And threw them into the furnace in front of her eyes.
Her husband did that?
Yeah, her husband, Lucille's father.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And
I mean, it says a lot about... one of the things that just hit me immediately was about Lucille Clifton, who, as I've said before, I knew because she was my neighbor for so many years when she lived in Windsor Hills, which is the home that she lost. I remember people fighting to help her keep that home.
Yeah.
That if young people would hear her and hear her story, she says a lot about the life you can lead as an artist despite what happens around you.
Yeah. It was what sustained her, and because she could get her quality into her art, it sustained other people. You know, it wasn't just a way of getting out her private pain. That wouldn't have been enough for her. It was a way of connecting it to other people so that they could recognize it. You know, the people who might not be able to find the words, or the people whose words were, you know, were burned up like that. If they could find it for herself, yeah, she was a great teacher and mentor, and she tried to bring that out in people. But she also tried to speak for them.
Tell me what you think her place is in our not just the world we're in, but that as well, but just in the world of art and poetry. Tell me where you place Lucille in that, and what she was.
Well, I'd place her in the top ranks of American poets for all of our history. I mean, she. She was a new voice in that pantheon, but she created that space for herself. She's on a par with any of our great American poets, and the one I most link her to, I guess, is Whitman. In that sense of being able to see in her. Private pain in her own history, a national wounding, a national vision. Connect herself to that.
And I know that despite her illness, that her death came, and it was a shock to you. Despite her, whatever she went through, no one was expecting her to leave them, were they?
No, I mean, she had gone, she'd come through so much, which as I said, should have killed her. And you know, she wasn't that old. I mean, she was 74 when I saw her. She looked always in the last few years. She looked tired for many reasons. But you know, that was just Lucille. She just went on and on and on. She was a force. So it was a shock, and it was sudden.
Tell me how you'd like us all to remember her.
I can tell you the way I like to remember her, which is sitting across the table with an impish smile on her face, very, very aware of the ironies of the world.
Wayne Carlin, thank you so much. I'm glad you could be part of this memorial to the great poet and human being, Lucille Clifton.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's hear Lucille Clifton reading her work at St. Mary's College of Maryland in 1990.
I want to start with this one because I was talking with Wayne in the car coming here, and he didn't realize that I was born with 12 fingers. I thought everybody knew that. People have asked me, what is that a metaphor for? And I hardly ever think about metaphor. And I tried to explain, this is not a metaphor for anything. I was born with 12 fingers. And so this is a poem about that. I was born with 12 fingers, like my mother and my daughter. Each of us born wearing strange black gloves, extra baby fingers hanging over the sides of our cribs and dipping into the milk. Somebody was afraid we would learn to cast spells and our wonders were cut off, but they didn't understand the powerful memory of ghosts. Now we take what we want with invisible fingers. And we connect my dead mother, my live daughter, and me through our terrible, shadowy hands.
Michael Glaser was the Poet Laureate of Maryland and taught with Lucille Clifton at St. Mary's College of Maryland.
I guess it was the day after Lucille had died. And she struggled physically within her body, but also in her mind. I mean, I think she felt, as Wayne does, you know, when you talk to Wayne, this profound sadness that nothing we seem to do can fix the world. And in the sky, it was a beautiful evening, and there was the what Wordsworth calls the old moon and the new moon's lap, that wonderful cradle of the new moon. And I thought, how wonderful. You know, Lucille's up there resting and not having to deal with all this stuff that is in our brains about what we're doing to ourselves. It's just amazing.
But she did deal with it, didn't she, in her life?
Pardon me?
She did deal with it
absolutely.
In her life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, I think Part of what I treasured about her was this kind of fierce integrity to not pretend otherwise, you know?
I mean, I'm curious, because you were both poet laureates, right, of the state of Maryland.
Right.
And you were dear friends and colleagues.
I like to call ourselves co-collaborators.
Why did you say that?
Well, I mean, we worked together at St. Mary's for 15 years and worked to try to create a sense of community around poets and poetry that were committed to creating a more compassionate, more civil world. And so, I mean, that was really one of the great joys for me, of working with her at St. Mary's to do that and supporting her work in the world to try to achieve that. And it was not something we talked about explicitly that way, you know, like Lucille ever said, this is my goal, but it's certainly what I felt about her life and her work and her poetry, that deeply, deeply committed to justice and to talk to people in a way that included them in not being part of the problem, but rather part of the solution, even though we were part of the problem, and we all damn well knew it.
So I'd like to talk a bit about, Michael, what you think about her significance was as a poet, and maybe in that also about the significance of poetry.
I think a lot of her significance as a poet came around her courage to create spaces where our fears and our shadows could feel safe enough to emerge into the light, where places where compassion and empathy could make their claims on our lives. And that's what she struggled with in her life, too. And I don't know if struggle is the right word, but that she always was working to create space in her life so that her own shadow self could emerge into the light, that the difficulties and hardships of her life could transform themselves into forces for the good, forces for life. And she worked to create that in the communities that she lived in. Her passion to make people understand that life was rarely either or, but always both and her ability to embrace paradox and the seeming contradictions of profound truths. I think that weaves its way, threads its way through all of her poetry and all of her presentations, and I think profoundly important in the world of poetry. That kind of a deep spiritual trust in the potential decency of all human beings that that carried her and carried her poems. I think that's something about why she's been so important to people and to poetry.
Kathleen Glazer was principal at Hollywood Elementary School in 1984 when Lucille Clifton came to her school to speak to the students. Kathleen sat down with us to talk about how this incredibly powerful friendship grew and developed with Lucille Clifton after that moment.
I met her in 1984 when we brought her to the school. Of course, I, as many elementary schools did, you know, invited her not just because of her being a well-known poet, but also because of her children's books. And I think I knew that day when I was driving her from Hollywood Elementary to St. Mary's College that we could become really good friends. Just the nature of our conversation on that drive let me know we could talk about anything, including the black-white tensions in our culture that we both carried with great sadness in our hearts. And I, of course, learned so much from her. Her friendship, you know, was a great, great gift to my life and a great loss. It's a month ago today that her daughters called to say that, the doctors at Hopkins thought that she was going to die. Okay, sorry for getting...
It's okay.
I guess one of the couple of things I thought about that I had wanted to tell you is one of the phrases she taught me, and she certainly said it to groups and libraries and schools, and she's quoting another person here. The concept is that children's books should have windows and mirrors in them, and part of what provoked her really to begin creating the Everett Anderson books, and you might know this, is that as she was reading to her own children, which of course six of them born within 7 years, that she wasn't finding images of African American children in the children's books. And so when she talked to teachers and librarians, she would say the importance of a book having a mirror and reflection in it of the children who are reading it. And also the importance of books having windows out onto a larger world, a world that they didn't know much about. You know, she delivered truths so powerfully. I still have a vivid image of her saying either group, children who don't have books with mirrors in them and children who don't have books with windows on a world different than the one they're living in or larger, both of those groups are disadvantaged. And, of course, I'm not a poet myself, but I have lived my life surrounded by poets my adult life and treasure, you know, treasure the way the poetry speaks to the soul and nourishes our spirits. And I like her 9/11, you know, poems called September Song. She does a poem for each day beginning with September 11th. I was just looking at the one that's Friday, September 14th, 01, which begins, "Some of us know we have never felt safe. All of us Americans weeping, as some of us have wept before." So that wonderful inclusiveness, but always acknowledging, too, the wounds of people who have been seen in our society as less than, or you know, not as important, or not full members of our society. She helped me and so many others just expand our hearts to include so many more people.
Kathy, I want to just say that you may not be a poet, but your words are like poetry.
Subdivision. I live in Cedar Cove, which is a development. And I tell people that that's one of the reasons that I know karma is real, because I used to talk about people who lived in developments. And I didn't talk about them nicely. And so the universe put me in a development to prove something or other, which I thought I already knew. One of the things I noticed in our development is that that the trees seem to be expendable. And I've lived in California for 5 years, and in California you don't go around touching trees unless you have a very good reason. And in Cedar Cove, they just bulldoze the trees down to build a house, and then they put a little one close by, you know. There seems to be very little reverence for life. I think there is a thing which bothers me about people not having reverence for life that doesn't look like themselves. And I think that's a great mistake. Anyway, one day I was at home because I wasn't feeling well. When I'm not feeling well, my mind really gets quirky. It sort of goes into like overdrive or underdrive or something. And I was looking out the window and they were building a house next to me. And they were bulldozing down the tree. And the tree suddenly took on the appearance of a warrior chief, because the branches were like falling back as the tree was going down, and the guy was in it like doing this macho thing. I know it was macho. It was like, and his buddies were like saying, "Yeah, get it, whoa, yeah." And it was like, you know, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm on the Trail of Tears, you know. And the tree was being valiant. So I wanted to write about it. Something you want to know is that Pahuska is the Lakota name for Custer. You know Custer? Custer had a very bad day many years ago. The things did not go his way. And Pahuska means long hair. And the Lakota people called Custer Pahuska. It's always, as an aside, it's always interesting to me that Pahuska and Custer and Crazy Horse had the same nickname as children. They were both called Curly as children. And another thing to know is that there was a photograph, a very famous photograph, one of the places it appears in a book called Touch the Earth, of an old warrior who was frozen on the Trail of Tears. And he's lying in the snow and he has his arm up. So this is called The Killing of the Trees. The third went down with a sound almost like flaking. A soft swish as the left leaves fluttered themselves and died. Three of them, four, then five, stiffening in the snow, as if this hill were wounded knee, as if the slim feathered branches were bonnets of war, as if the pale man seated high in the bulldozer nest, his blonde mustache ice-matted, was Pahuska come again, but stronger now, his long hair wild and unrelenting. Remember the photograph? The old warrior, his stiffened arm raised as if in blessing, his frozen eyes open, his dark skin browned and not so much sprinkled as circled with age, and the snow everywhere still falling, covering his one good leg. Remember his name was Spotted Tail or Hump or Red Cloud or Geronimo or none of these or all of these. He was a chief. He was a tree falling the way a chief falls. Straight, eyes open, arms reaching for his mother ground. So I have come to live among the men who kill the trees, a subdivision new in southern Maryland. I have brought my witness eye with me and my two wild hands, the left one sister to the fists pushing the bulldozer against the old oak, the angry right brown and hard and spotted as bark. We come in peace. But this morning, ponies circle what is left of life, and whales and continents and children and ozone and trees huddle in a camp weeping outside my window. And I can see it all with that one good eye.
You're listening now to a special on Lucille Clifton, reproduced right after she passed away on this day in 2010. We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we hear the rest of our tribute to the great Lucille Clifton. And right under us right now, the Star Spangled Banner, performed by none other than the amazing great late Marvin Gaye at the NBA All-Star Game on this day in 1983.
Out of jail, California dreaming. Soon as I step on the scene, I'm hearing Hoochie screaming. Fiending for money and alcohol. The life of a West Side player with cows die in a strong ball. Only in Cali will we riot, not rally to live and die. In LA, we wear chucks, not valleys.
Yeah, that's right.
Dressed in loafs and khaki suits and ride is what we do. Flossing but have caution, we collide with other fruits. Famous because we throw grams. Worldwide, let them recognize from Long Beach to Rosecrans. Bumping and grinding like a slow jam. It's West Side, so you know the road will bow.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Tupac Shakur, California Love. All Eyes on Me was released on this day in 1996. It was the first rap double album on a major label, and we're going to sell over 10 million copies in the United States. This hour, we're listening back to a special we produced on Lucille Clifton after she passed away in 2010. She was the Poet Laureate of Maryland and was my neighbor and friend. She died on this day 5 years ago. Let's get right back to our special on Lucille Clifton.
I'd like to read two poems. They're both fairly new. The first is called Aunt Jemima. It's in the voice of Aunt Jemima. White folks say I remind them of home. I, who have been homeless all my life, except for their kitchen cabinets. I, who have made the best of everything. Pancakes, batter for chicken, my life. The shelf on which I sit between the flour and cornmeal is thick with dreams. Oh, how I long for my own syrup, rich as blood, my true nephews, my nieces, my kitchen, my family, my home. Thank you. Thank you. This is called After Blues. The epithing is, I hate to see the evening sun go down. My mother's son died in his sleep, and so did mine. Both of them found, though years apart, cold on a bed of trouble, hands folded in unexpected prayer, my brother, my son. My mama was right. There's blues in the night.
Ethelbert Miller is an internationally renowned poet and literary activist. He's on the board of the Institute for Policy Studies and director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University.
So I'd like you just to share with us a bit about your thoughts as both a friend and a fellow poet of Lucille Clifton and what you think she represented for to and for all of us and as a poet.
Well, you know, Lucille Clifton is a writer I met in 1974, and I was introduced to her by the poet, Southern poet Amazu Bolton, who died a few years ago. Amazu Bolton was here working with me at Howard and the African American Resource Center, and he knew Lucille Clifton. He had published some of her work in, you know, some little magazines. And I had just started up my Ascension Poetry Reading Series, and Amazu, you know, contacted Lucille. And Lucille came to my third Ascension program on Howard University's campus. Came down on her own, you know, no real honorarium or anything because we didn't have any money then.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's my first guest on my Ascension series. And I never forgot that, you know. And, you know, it was her first, I believe, her first reading on the campus of Howard University, a school she had attended back in the 50s. So it was a real, like a homecoming for her, and I wasn't even aware of that. But I give credit. You know, the Amazu Bolton, who was very close to Lucille Clifton. In fact, I found in one of my books as I was going back, you know, through my library after Lucille died, and I found stuck in the pages of one of Lucille's books an unpublished poem that she wrote for Amos, you know.
Really?
Yeah, and it was just really nice reading that again and, you know, just brought back this sort of friendship. But what I liked about Lucille Clifton as a writer, in terms of the person I looked up to, I always felt that Lucille Clifton had an aura or glow. You know, she talked about the light, you know, coming to her.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that you really saw a woman on a spiritual path. And when we look at her work, we see this journey. You know, for example, you go back to her, one of her, you know, signature poems, Good Times. You know, that is a poem which to me is very remarkable because it celebrates the black family. You know, and in that short poem, you find the African-American male presence is there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the father, the uncle, you know, everybody is in that house, and it's good times. You know, and I like that aspect of her celebrating the black family. And then in poems, Homage to Her Hips or Homage to Her Hair, you see Lucille Clifton celebrating the black body. See, celebrating the black body in terms of how a black woman defined themselves, you know, with the hips, with the hair, and not apologizing for it, you know. I always felt that in these short poems that was part of her style, Lucille Clifton's poem knew how to strut. You know, they knew how to strut across the page. You know what I'm saying? And they were unapologetic, you know.
Uh-huh.
Homage to my hips. These hips are big hips. They need space to move around in. They don't fit in a little petty places. These hips are free hips. They don't like to be held back. These hips have never been enslaved. They go where they want to go. They do what they want to do. These hips are mighty hips. These hips are magic hips. I have known them to put a spell on a man and spin him like a top.
I'll read you one of my favorite Lucille Clifton poems, which is from her collection, Next.
Oh, great.
And this is a poem that when I heard it, it just resonated with me. Why some people be mad at me sometimes. They ask me to remember, but they want me to remember their memories. And I keep on remembering mine. And that's a very short poem.
Mm.
But you can say, okay, do your PhD around this. You know what I'm saying? You know, because this is a struggle over the control of one's narrative.
Uh-huh.
You know, this is a whole issue of identity, you know, feeling in place, out of place. You know, and also we have a tendency of projecting stories onto people, history onto other people, not realize that they have their own. You see? And we see this when we look at the issues that we're confronted with as a society around the issues of education. What is to be taught? You see, who controls the first chapter? Who's on the cover of the historical textbooks?
Mm-hmm.
You see, and in this small line, I mean, I think that when you look at Lucille Clifton, you know, she practices what we would call the economy of words. You know, what you find is this sort of minimalist style, in which the poems are really compact. You know, and similar to like how you would look at some of the poems that Langston Hughes gave us. Where someone would say, well, Langston Hughes, you know, he's not Ezra Pound, you know. This poem seems a little simplistic. No. You know, these poems are like little solar cells, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They pack a lot of energy, and you just have to realize in terms of take the time to recognize how much power and energy are in these, you know, few lines that Lucille Clifton gives us.
And as you were speaking, Ethelbert, it made me think that just the power of her poetry, as you said, what she puts in small places,
mm-hmm.
the power that comes out of that,
mm-hmm.
And the black experience, the human experience, but also the idea that we had this incredible poet and spirit who lived among us here in this
community.
Well,
but see, she's in the tradition. You know, when you look at Lucille Clifton moving around this area, well, you know, keep in mind, I always tell people Frederick Douglass ran away from Maryland. You know, he knew what freedom was about. He knew what it is. I mean, you know, when you look at Maryland and you're dealing with the backdrop of the Civil War and things of that sort, well, yes, okay, if Walt Whitman's going to be walking around here, so should Lucille Clifton. You know, and so she's part of the American tradition. And then I look at her in terms of her spiritual growth. That's what I look at. I look at a poet who's on the path, who works, draws upon, you know, the Bible for inspiration, you know, some Buddhism for inspiration, you know. And at the same time, you find these poems that document the political changes. So you see in some of the short poems, Lucille Clifton writing about the Black Panthers. You see her writing about South Africa. So, you know, she is aware of the world around her that is changing, and it's documented in her work. And to some extent, she becomes a poet of witness.
A witness to her life, to the life of the black world, the life of our world in toto. I mean, she was all that.
Oh, yeah, and if you want to add something, you know, for Lucille Clifton passing at this time, I think this is the symbolism. She passes like the day before Valentine's Day, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of reminding us about love in our hearts, you know. Then as an example, if you look at a woman who, to me, you could just take to the hill and say, okay, you want to know why we need health care? This is what Lucille Clifton went through in her life.
mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
She would just be a test from her kidneys to, you know, every other part of her. You know? I mean, she would be a testament. You know, I think it's very painful when a mother loses their children. You know? I mean, look at how much Lucille had to deal with death. Okay? And then in the later years, she became, very, very public with her private life. Okay? And so all of a sudden, you know, she's writing about this sort of abuse within the household.
As
and that
a child,
takes a certain courage,
right.
You see. But I, you know, if Lucille Clifton was still living, I have her on the hill. Obama, you know, this is why we need health care. Just listen to Lucille. <You know?
laughs>
And then it would be the light that came to Obama.
Well, we could only hope. That would be great.
We could only hope.
Ethelbert Miller, it's lovely to hear your remembrances of Lucille Clifton.
And one last thing I have to say. This woman was born with six fingers on each hand. That's a reminder, Mark. Six fingers.
I'll remember that.
Right. No, let if those six fingers touch the back of your head, Mark, whoa. We're talking something more powerful than FM, brother.
Amen to that.
All right.
Thank you, Ethelbert.
Okay.
Let's go now to Lucille Clifton reading her work at the St. Mary's College of Maryland in 1990.
This is called White Lady. White Lady is a street name for cocaine. White Lady. Wants my son. Wants my niece. Wants Josie's daughter. Holds them hard and close as slavery. What will it cost to keep our children? What will it cost to pay them, to buy them back? White Lady says, I want you. Whispers, let me be your lover. Whispers, run me through your fingers. Feel me, smell me, taste me, love me. Nobody understands you like White Lady. White Lady, you have chained our sons in the basement of the big house. White Lady, you have walked our daughters out into the streets. White Lady, what do we have to pay to repossess our children? White Lady, what do we have to owe to own our own at last?
And now we're talking with Kenneth Carroll, a well-known poet, a good friend of Lucille Clifton, who is a playwright. And much more, nominated for the 2004 Pushcart Prize for Poetry, and joins us here. Kenneth, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Talk a bit about your relationship with Lucille Clifton and how you came to know her.
I you know, like probably millions of Lucille Clifton fans, came to know her first through her writings and being a young poet and just finding her work just amazing, you know, really stunning. First coming upon her work and just thinking, you know, one, you know, I'd like to write with the kind of power this woman writes with. And interestingly enough, I ended up one of her poems called Listen Children. I remember teaching that poem to my then 5-year-old son, and he eventually memorizes the poem and reads it at school. And so that's how I really became familiar with her work and kind of fell in love with her work, and then transmitted that love to my son, my older son.
How did you first meet?
I ended up meeting Lucille Clifton, funny enough, the first time at the White House under Bill Clinton, who was having some kind of a program at the White House, and Michael Glaser was there, and I believe Grace Cavalieri, and I walked up to Lucille Clifton, and I had a recording of my son reading her poem called Listen Children. And I gave her a copy of that recording, and I said, you know, my son loved your poetry, and they've actually, and in his school, in his first grade class, they were actually reading Lucille Clifton poems as part of their class.
Was she the poet laureate then?
Yeah, I believe she was the poet laureate at that time, and we talked about that. The thing about her that was so amazing to me is, you know, Lucille Clifton is just one of the most approachable people in the world. You just feel like, you know, 2 minutes into meeting her, like you've known her your whole life. And so I'm there, you know, this poet, you know, that, you know, relative to her unknown, and yet she's talking to me like, you know, we've been old buddies, you know. And like you say, she was just somebody that I think a lot of poets gravitated to because of who she was as a human being, in addition to being a great writer.
Start with a poem that's older, and it was written for my mother, and her birthday was November 1st, and she would have been 94. She died when she was 44, out of body. The words, they fade. I sift toward other languages. You must listen with your hands, with the twist ends of your hair. That leaf, pick up the sharp green stem. Try to feel me, feel you. I am saying I still love you. I am saying, I am trying to say from my mouth. But oh, baby, there is no mouth. My family is a very short-lived family, and I often wonder why I lived in what in my family is a very long time. I think it's stubbornness, you know? How dare they say we're short-lived in my family? Anyway, this is from a new book, and it is called, the book is called Voices. And I often wonder, I've always wondered, some of the questions that people don't know how to answer. I'm very interested in names, naming. You know, I never know, why is this a podium? Why is this not a microphone? Why is this not a podium? You know, don't you wonder that sort of thing? Probably not. My kids always say, you wonder things nobody cares about. And that's probably true. But I think about naming, and I think about Mataoka, who was called Pocahontas. And Mataoka was not her name, it was one of her nicknames. But we call her Pocahontas, and we think she should be happy with that. My students at St. Mary's College at one point went to the Smithsonian and saw the portrait of she called Pocahontas. And they told me it wasn't a true portrait of her, because they had seen the movie. Now, that is animation, you know. So somebody drew a pretty little girl, pretty little white girl, decided that she was Pocahontas. And that the romance between them, she was something like 14 and he had to be 115, was a true romance. And I question everything, and that's one of the things. Mataoka, this is her voice. In the dream was white men walking up from the river. In the dream was our land stolen away and our homes and our names. In the dream was my father fighting to save us. In the dream, the pipe was broken. And I was leaning my body across the whimpering man. If our father loves revenge more than he loves his children, said the dream, we need to know it now. That always makes me think of President Bush.
What of her poems grabs you the most? Can you remember certain ones that really just said stay with you?
Yeah, I mean, I taught poetry at Arts High School here in Washington, D.C. for about 4 or 5 years.
Ellington? You taught at Ellington?
Yeah, at the Ellington School for the Arts.
Yeah.
And I used to have my students commit to memory one of Lucille's poems, Won't You Celebrate With Me, which is just a masterpiece of a poem. And part of the reason I wanted my students to memorize that piece is, you know, it's almost like an ars poetica for Lucille, but it's also this notion of the artist's ability to kind of, you know, make themselves, to find space in the world for themselves through the creation of their art. And to me, that's one of her most powerful pieces.
I'm curious, as you were talking about this, since you also are a very fine poet, what you think she imparts on the rest of us when it comes to the power of poetry in this world, because we often shunt poetry aside as something less meaningful than mathematics or something else.
Well, I mean, see, that and that's, you know, probably, you know, part of the difficulty for us as a society is understanding the necessity of art, you know, and I just felt like in Lucille Clifton's work, the what she brought was a kind of, you know, even though she, you know, she was an academic and she did teach, I think her work reached, you know, beyond the academy. I think it came from a place, you know, that it was organic, that she was not writing to impress her colleagues, but, you know, really writing to reach, you know, people who, you know, work 9-to-5 jobs, or people who one wouldn't think would enjoy poetry. I mean, I think she wrote with as authentic a voice as we've seen in American literature.
That couldn't be said better from what you just said. I really do appreciate you taking this time with us today to talk about Lucille Clifton.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come, celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
That was Lucille Clifton, former Poet Laureate of Maryland. She died on this day, 2010. In Your Eyes by the great Peter Gabriel, born on this day in 1950. It's a brief break. We'll be right back. Stay with us.